From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The attackers had pump-action shotguns, AK-47s, pistols with silencers, and a stun gun, hardly the weapons used by the Iraqi resistance. It took place blocks from the Green Zone. Whoever did this had to have had resources beyond those of the Iraqi resistance.
Today we take a look at the events surrounding the abduction of the two Italian and two Iraqi humanitarian workers last week. We'll speak with Democracy Now!'s Jeremy Scahill. Then a debate on one of the most important voter issues this year, health care. But first, we go to New Orleans, which narrowly avoided a catastrophe this morning when Hurricane Ivan crashed ashore in Alabama. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. A new top secret CIA study has concluded that the ongoing troubles in Iraq may lead to a civil war by the end of next year. The warning comes in a classified national intelligence estimate that was approved by acting CIA Director John McLaughlin in July before the recent upsurge in violence. The New York Times revealed the existence of the report today. One government official who saw the classified report said, quote, "There's a significant amount of pessimism. The government is predicting the worst-case scenario foresees developments that could lead to civil war. The most favorable scenario predicts a tenuous stability in political, economic, and security terms." The Times notes that the tone of the report stands in direct contrast to recent statements by the Bush administration. Yesterday, Senate Republicans on the Foreign Relations Committee criticized the president's request to divert more than $3 billion from reconstruction projects to security measures. Of the $18.4 billion Congress approved last year for Iraqi reconstruction, only $1.1 billion has been spent because of violence and other problems. Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska called the record, quote, "beyond pitiful and embarrassing. It is now in the zone of dangerous," he said. Hagel said the shift in funds shows the U.S. is, quote, "in deep trouble." Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting that Bush administration officials are hoping to make an upcoming visit to Washington by unelected Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, the centerpiece of a vigorous election year defense of its troubled Iraq policy. Next week, Alawi is expected to address a joint session of Congress and speak at the opening session of the United Nations General Assembly. A new report by the Government Accountability Office warns the U.S. military may run out of National Guard and Reserve troops for the war on terrorism because of existing limits on involuntary mobilizations. Since the September 11th attacks, more than 335,000 Guard and Reserve have been involuntarily mobilized for active duty. The report also notes the Army National Guard has failed to meet recruiting goals in 14 of 20 months between October 2002 and May 2004. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has accused the U.S. of illegally invading Iraq and said the attack contravened the Charter of the United Nations. Annan's comments came during an interview with the BBC. Annan said, quote, "I hope we do not see another Iraq-type operation for a long time without UN approval and much broader support from the international community. From our point of view," he said, "and the UN Charter point of view, it was illegal." In news from Iraq, two U.S. citizens and a British citizen were kidnapped today when 10 gunmen stormed a house where they were in central Baghdad. The men are believed to be private contractors. We'll be looking today in the program at the abduction of the two Italian and two Iraqi humanitarian workers on September 7th. And the controversy over last week's 60 Minutes report on President Bush's military service in the Texas Air National Guard continues. For the first time, CBS News and Dan Rather admitted the possibility that their report was based on forged documents, but Rather continued to stand by his reporting.
The story is true. I believe and still believe that the documents are authentic. But we are continuing to investigate, and people have been drawing me to level with them if it turns out that they are not authentic. I believe they are, but if it turns out they aren't, I'd like to break that story.
The documents in question were allegedly from the personal files of the late Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Killian, who served as Bush's squadron leader in the Texas Air National Guard. Yesterday, Rather interviewed Killian's secretary, Marion Carr Knox. She told CBS she believes the documents are fake, but they reflected the sentiments of Killian.
I know that I didn't type. However, the information in those is correct.
In other developments, the New York Times is reporting an unnamed employee at CBS is saying the source of the controversial documents was Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett. Burkett is the Texas Air National Guardsman who's previously said he witnessed Bush's military records being purged in the late 1990s as the then governor was preparing to run for the White House. The Financial Times is reporting factions within the Bush administration are debating whether the U.S. should consider carrying out military strikes against Iran to stop its nuclear program. The paper reports analysts close to the administration say military options are under consideration, but have not reached a level of seriousness that indicate the U.S. is preparing actual action. An Afghan court yesterday sentenced three Americans to up to 10 years in prison after finding them guilty of charges that included running a private jail and torturing detainees during a self-appointed counterterrorism mission. One of the men, Jonathan Edema, is a former U.S. soldier who claims he and his co-defendants came to Afghanistan with official backing from the U.S. military and the Afghan government. For the first time, the State Department has named Saudi Arabia as a country that severely violates religious freedom. Saudi Arabia joins seven other countries on the list, including Burma, China, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, Eritrea, and Vietnam. The State Department determined that freedom of religion does not exist in Saudi Arabia and that, quote, non-Muslim worshipers risk arrest, imprisonment, lashing, deportation, and sometimes torture. Israeli forces killed 10 Palestinians yesterday in the deadliest day in the West Bank for Palestinians in more than 2 years. In Nablus, Israel killed five Palestinian militants and an 11-year-old girl. Later in Jenin, two Palestinian civilians, a police officer, and one militant was killed in an attack on a car repair shop. Meanwhile, Palestinians are marking the 22nd anniversary of the Sabra and Shatila massacre this week. In 1982, up to 2,000 unarmed Palestinian refugees were slaughtered near Beirut by Lebanese Christian militia forces allied with Israeli forces. At the time, General Ariel Sharon was Israel's defense minister. And in Knoxville, Tennessee, the Federal Communications Commission has shut down community radio station KFAR. Yesterday morning, three federal marshals raided the station's studios and confiscated all of the station's equipment. The three-year-old station was operating without an FCC license, though it was in the process of applying for one. One supporter of the station said, quote, "The real criminals are the FCC officials who've given the public airways away to huge media conglomerates like Clear Channel." KFAR stands for Knoxville First Amendment Radio.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time. The time. So weary all the time. When he went away, the blues walked in and met me. If he stays away, old rocking chair will get me. All I do is...
Billie Holiday, Stormy Weather. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners, viewers, and those listening in on www.democracynow.org.
Juan, congratulations on your major award.
Yes, the Hispanic Heritage Award Foundation had their event at the Kennedy Center on Friday, actually, and gave me the Leadership Award, along with some other folks, Sandra Benitez, who won for Literature, the writer, and John Leguizamo, the actor. And it was, it's one of these usual, very nice black tie events, a little bit more than normal for me. But the actual broadcast, because there's quite a bit of entertainment that was involved also, so the actual broadcast will be on the NBC stations this Saturday evening. So if anybody's interested in watching it, they have to check their local TV guide for exactly what hour on Saturday night it'll be broadcast over NBC.
And we'll put it on the website at democracynow.org. Yeah. But again, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. But now we're going to turn to Hurricane Ivan. The hurricane slammed into the Gulf Coast early today with devastating winds and pounding waves that ripped homes apart, destroyed power lines, and flooded deep inland. After a deadly rampage across the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico that left 68 people dead, Hurricane Ivan made landfall near the town of Gulf Shores, Alabama, at about 3 a.m. Eastern time this morning. But the storm, which is the size of Texas, was felt over a huge stretch of the coast and inland in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Florida, where nearly 2 million residents were ordered to evacuate their homes. Thousands of people huddled in shelters, and hundreds of thousands were left without power. Hours before Ivan came ashore, its outer edges spawned tornadoes, blamed for the deaths of two people in Panama City Beach, Florida.
But it was New Orleans, the largest U.S. city below sea level, that was particularly vulnerable to flooding. The city's emergency manager yesterday warned as many as 50,000 people could drown if New Orleans was hit by a strong Category 4 storm. The city has 10,000 body bags on hand in case of a catastrophe. While many New Orleans residents took officials' advice and left town, a large group of people, mostly concentrated in poorer neighborhoods, didn't have a choice. They had to stay and hope for the best. There was no public transportation or evacuation plan. 100,000 people stranded in the city. In a moment, we're going to go to New Orleans, but we're going to begin with David Helvarg. He's president of the Blue Frontier Campaign and author of the books The War Against the Greens and, more recently, Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. Well, David Helvarg, we are having you on again as the storm continue, another one on the horizon as well, and again raising this issue that we are now looking at almost wall-to-wall weather coverage in this country with these massive storms. And yet, I have yet to see the words global warming or hear them. Your comment, what does this indicate?
Hi, Amy. This is the new normality. Even if we didn't have the additional add-ons of fossil fuel-driven climate change, we have these 25 to 40-year cycles of lesser and greater hurricane activity. And the 60s to the 90s was lesser activity, where you averaged 1.5 landfalls per season. Now this is the new normality. 3 hurricane landfalls per season is what we can expect between now and about 2040. And, of course, by then, nobody will be debating the added kick-in, the erosion, sea level rise, and intensified storms linked to climate. But, as I say, the only difference between the last period of intensified hurricanes back in the 50s and 60s and today is massive coastal sprawl. 17 of our 20 fastest growing counties are coastal now. And oddly, instead of taking precautions, instead of being aware that we're at risk from intensified Atlantic hurricanes, from climate change, policy continues to support kind of a high-risk coastal sprawl that both destroys the coastal environment and puts millions of people in harm's way. We've got a government report that says 25% of all houses within 500 feet of the ocean will be gone in the next 50 years, and yet we have a federal flood insurance system that drives the development. Gulf Shores, which is taking the brunt of it, of Hurricane Ivan, in 79 it was hit by, it used to be all beach shacks there. I've been down the Alabama coast. It used to be lovely. 79, Hurricane Frederick took out all the beach shacks, and because the federal subsidies were there, the developers replaced them with 14-story condominiums, which are now being ground up into glass shards this morning. I was down in Dauphin Island, Alabama, 2 years ago, and you've got literally hundreds of rental units on the beach on stilts. At least you had them. They may all be gone now. It's a strange system, and stranger still is that we're in a state of denial. You know, we're driving development in these high-risk areas.
Well, David, about that development, clearly, as you say, increasingly upper-income people are moving, having these enormous mansions and condominiums along ocean fronts and in the path of potential hurricanes, and it ends up with the insurance industry and then the federal government with its disaster relief bailing out folks who are actually building in areas where they shouldn't be. What are the responses of the politicians to this obvious invitation to economic disaster?
For the most part, the response has been to encourage it. I mean, we now have $673 billion of federally insured flood sites, and half of these homes in Florida, and the most expensive are in places like North Captiva, Florida, where the flood insurance program began in 68, and then they quickly realized this was a driver of development, because once you had the federal flood insurance, the banks would provide the mortgages, and you had things like this transformation of Gulf Shores, Alabama. So in 82, the Congress realized this was a mistake, and they excluded about over a million acres of barrier islands, which we probably should change their name to death by drowning islands, since people don't seem to understand what they're barriers against. Over a million acres were excluded, and since the 104th Congress, since the Gingrich Congress, they've been making, these congressmen have been proposing technical corrections to take out acreage to allow it to get its subsidies back. And one example, during the first of these, during Hurricane Charley, North Captiva became North and Far North Captiva. It was broken up by Charley. About a quarter of that island was excluded from subsidies until 99, when Porter Goss, who's now up for CIA director, came in with a technical correction 2 days before the Thanksgiving break, and he got 200 acres of North Captiva back into the federal flood insurance system. So and there have been some 50 structures built since then, and we don't know until the final damage assessments how many millions of our tax dollars, how many family farmers in Iowa are going to be paying to rebuild a second home estates in North Captiva. It's the richest zip code in America.
David Hulvarg, we're also joined by Mark Schlestein, who is Pulitzer Prize-winning environmental reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He joins us on the phone from his office in New Orleans, where he spent the night. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, in one sense, it is a good morning for you in New Orleans. It looks like Hurricane Ivan has crashed onto the shore in Alabama, not New Orleans.
Right. We're. I'm sure that as we move out this morning to take a look around, there's going to be some minor damage in the city itself, and maybe some more extensive damage south of us along the Louisiana coastline on the east side of the Mississippi River. But for us, we you know, this was not the big one, so to speak. It did what Hurricane George did in 1998, in that at the last minute it moved to the east enough to spare us from a catastrophic storm surge.
Could
Yeah, Mark, your newspaper had a story yesterday about the advice of officials to many residents in New Orleans to move out of the storm's path, but yet there was the problem of up to 100,000 poor New Orleans who could not New Orleans residents who could not evacuate because they didn't have own cars. Could you talk about that story and what happened?
Sure. Fortunately, like I said, things weren't horrendous here, so that became a semi non problem this time. But it is it's the elephant in the room in Louisiana. What is going to happen when the worst case scenario hits, and there are all these people who can't get out? There's talk about some grand plan for moving people to some sort of structure that would provide them with at least a refuge. The mayor of New Orleans yesterday opened up the Superdome to act as that refuge, and fortunately few people took advantage of it. I think there were 1,200 people who did. In the two-hour period that they were allowed to make that decision, get to a staging area, and be bused to the Superdome and allowed in, when there really is a serious one, I think you'll see a rush of buses to get people to a variety of different structures with the explanation that this is a refuge, not a shelter. There is nothing there for you. You have to bring everything yourself. And it's going to be a disaster. Engineers have gone through the city, building engineers, civil engineers have done a survey of the city and basically found that there are no public buildings with enough areas that would survive a catastrophic storm to actually act as refuges even in the city. And there's no effort yet to require new public buildings to withstand catastrophic hurricane winds.
Mark, very quickly, we were just commenting at the top of this segment that there's tremendous amount of coverage, obviously, on these monster hurricanes, but we rarely hear the words global warming in all of the weather coverage. Actually, the British Prime Minister Tony Blair yesterday said urgent action is needed to combat the world's greatest environmental challenge. But in this country, it's almost a concept people don't know about if they just get their information from the media.
Well,
as an environmental reporter, do you deal with this at the Times Picayune?
I'm not quite sure that's quite as rough as the way you're painting it. I know that in my newspaper, we have quite a few stories that deal with global climate change, some of which are directly aimed at the concern. Here in Louisiana, we have serious concerns about changes in our climate causing significant changes in the way we live. There are significant concerns about increased vectors being created by warmer and wetter weather here, everything from a return of malaria and yellow fever to newer diseases that may be popping in to the community. And, of course, our biggest problem here in Louisiana is sea level rise. Sadly, the joke here is that we don't have to wait for the additional sea level rise from climate change to cause problems from us. Our coastline already is in drastic danger. We are losing communities to sea level rise today, not in 25 years or 50 years or 100 years. It's happening now. So,
Mark Schlefstein, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. Mark Schlefstein is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Times-Picayune. Environmental reporter stayed in his office last night preparing for Hurricane Ivan. David Helvarg, president of the Blue Frontier Campaign. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk about health care, a debate on Bush and Kerry proposals, and then look at the four humanitarian workers who were abducted a few weeks ago in Iraq, two Iraqi, two Italian. What exactly happened during that abduction? Do we know more than has been reported? Stay with us.
If the earth could fly away, could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the earth could run away, could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could run away, if she could run away, so.
Battered Earth, Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to a healthcare debate. The presidential campaign has been dominated in recent weeks by the military records of President Bush and his contender, Senator John Kerry. But another issue is turning out to be one of the most important to voters in the election, healthcare.
Bush and Kerry have very different views on how the U.S. healthcare system should be run. Kerry is planning to expand the existing system of employer-provided insurance and federal health programs. Bush wants to rely on market-oriented alternatives to government programs. The Kerry campaign estimates that their health care plan would cost about $650 billion over 10 years and provide coverage for 27 million more Americans by expanding existing government programs and increasing subsidies for private insurance. This, according to the Los Angeles Times.
Bush's plan centers on tax breaks to encourage individuals to buy their own health insurance or to save for future expenses. Bush aides estimate that his plan would cost $145 billion over 10 years and provide coverage for more than 11 million uninsured people.
We're joined by Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University, co-director of the Harvard Medical School General Internal Medicine Fellowship Program. Also, Sally Pipes, president of the San Francisco-based Pacific Research Institute, author of the new book Miracle Cure, How to Solve America's Healthcare Crisis and Why Canada Isn't the Answer. Sally Pipes, let's begin with you, your assessment of what President Bush has proposed, as well as John Kerry.
Yes, good morning, Amy. I grew up in Canada under Canadian healthcare, and now the average wait in Canada from seeing a GP to a specialist has gone from, in 1993, from 9 weeks to 17.9 weeks. So we have two different plans here. President Bush's plan is talking about, you know, giving patients and doctors control over the health care rather than government bureaucrats. So he's looking at, health, you know, expanding health savings accounts to provide affordable coverage to individuals and businesses. He's talking about making changes in tort reform to reduce malpractice awards. He's setting up association health plans so small businesses can provide, can band together and provide coverage for their workers, and plus refundable tax credits for low-income Americans, individuals, and families. On the other hand, presidential candidate Kerry, his plan, in my estimates and those of others that economists that I work with, is about $1 trillion over 10 years. He's saying he will get this money through rescinding the Bush tax cuts. That would really only cover one-third of the cost. But the real issue in the Kerry plan is he is moving the he would move the American people more to a Canadian single-payer style system. This is just one step. It's really talking about putting millions of middle-income Americans into Medicaid, the federal state health program for the poor, and putting a million more Americans into a system of managed competition, which is similar to what Hillary Clinton proposed more than a decade ago. And I'll just make one point on that. You know, when you look at President Clinton and his terrible, you know, heart problem, he went into the doctor on a Thursday. He had an angiogram on Friday. On Monday, he had quadruple bypass. If he had lived in Canada, or if Hillary Clinton's plan had passed, he would be looking at an average wait of 3.4 weeks from seeing a GP to seeing a cardiologist, another 2.1 weeks for having urgent bypass. And if it wasn't that urgent, it would be 10.7 weeks. So his plan really is putting more and more government into our lives. The Bush plan is really talking about letting consumers be empowered to take control over their health care. And I think, in my opinion, having grown up under Canadian health care, this is the option that Americans will like. You can't take the American people into that program. It's just a government program. It's just not going to work.
And Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University, your response to the Bush plan and also your sense of Senator Kerry's plan entails.
I'll get to Bush and Kerry in a minute, but I can't let those falsehoods about Canada stand. When people look scientifically at weights in Canada, the average wait for urgent heart surgery is one day. The average wait for non-urgent heart surgery is 17 days. So Sally's numbers come from a crackpot research organization that has no credibility, and her organization has been spreading those numbers around, and they're simply not true. The truth is Canadians have complete free choice of doctor or hospital. They live 2 to 3 years longer than Americans, and they're spending about half of what we do on health care, and the reason is that they have so much administrative efficiency. By getting rid of the insurance companies and their paperwork, they can afford universal care. Now, our group, Physicians for a National Health Program, which is a leading advocate of single-payer health care, doesn't advocate the Canadian system. We advocate Canada Deluxe. That is, we would advocate spending the same amount we're spending now, about twice what they spend in Canada, but achieve the administrative efficiency and universal coverage of Canada so that we could cover everyone with no waits of any type. But getting back to the question of Bush and Kerry, Mr. Kerry gets us less than halfway there. Even if his plan is successful, he will leave 17 million Americans with no health insurance. And let's not pretend that's really universal health care. Mr. Bush's plan is actually quite a bit worse. He intends to pour money into tax credits, which will not succeed in covering people. We know that because Mr. Bush is modeling his plan after an existing tax credit program called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act, where less than 2% of eligible people have decided to take the tax credit. Now, the reason is Bush is talking about offering a tax credit of $3,000 for a family to buy health insurance, but the average family policy in this country costs $10,000. This would leave a family with $7,000 they'd have to take out of their own pocket in order to get health insurance. And obviously, a low-income family, an unemployed family, is not in a position to pay an additional $7,000 out of their pocket for health care. So hence, the tax credits are not going to be sufficient to allow low-income people to buy health insurance, and we're simply not going to get any coverage out of Mr. Bush.
Sally Pipes, your response, especially on this whole issue of the administrative cost savings as a result of the plans of Senator Kerry, and doesn't a bigger, more organized system with one buyer have power to control prices better and to prevent healthcare costs from spiraling?
The Canadian system is expensive. First of all, you're comparing apples with oranges. Canada doesn't include the capital costs of hospitals in their numbers. Canada has the third most expensive healthcare system in the world after the United States and Switzerland. Canadians, if you look on websites, you will see the stories of Canadians who are having to wait, who cannot get doctors, are leaving Canada to come to the United States. There's a woman in Quebec who is suing the Quebec government in a malpractice suit for $37 million because she had to, and she's suing on behalf of 10,000 Quebec breast cancer patients who had to wait over the limit of 8 weeks to get radiation oncology. This story, the Canadian Medical Association just came out with a report 2 weeks ago saying that over 50% of Canadians are incredibly dissatisfied with the health care that they are getting. Just look on websites and see the number of Canadians who are upset. And Canadians use America as a safety valve. Look at the border towns. Canadians, Senator Ed Lawson, who was head of the Teamsters Union and became a national senator, when he was diagnosed 2 years ago with heart situation similar to President Clinton, they told him the wait, even a person of such importance, importance as himself, left and came to went to Seattle, Washington, because he didn't want to wait 2 weeks to get an angiogram. So, you know, I'm not a crackpot institute. That was very insulting. I've done a lot of work. I worked in Canada on this issue. There are tremendous work done by the Fraser Institute in Canada on hospital waiting lists. It's all scientifically done. So the administrative costs in Canada, you're not comparing apples with apples. It is the third most expensive system in the world. And in the United States today, 45% of our health care dollars are actually in the government system between Medicaid, Medicare, the state children's health insurance program, and things like that.
Okay. I'm not calling Sally a crackpot. I'm calling Fraser Institute, who she quotes extensively, crackpot. This is a group that thinks we ought to privatize the whales. This is a group that thinks we should abolish medical licenses.
There should be private options in Canada. I think a lot of people in the United States think that Canada...
Okay, Sally, I'll let you talk, okay? Now it's my turn. The reality is Canada spends half of what we do. I happen to have published the definitive article on administrative costs in New England Journal of Medicine. I know what the Canadian hospital cost reports look like. I know what Canadian cost reports look like. Canada spends half of what we do, and that's what the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and the UN say. And that's the reason why they do have some weights for elective services in Canada. Elective services. Do I think that's a good thing? No. I don't think we should have to wait for things. But if we have a Canadian-style system and spend twice as much money, then there's no reason to have any weights. That's not just my opinion. It's also the opinion of the U.S. General Accounting Office and the U.S. Congressional Budget Office.
I'd like to ask Sally Pipes, what do you think is good about John Kerry's proposal?
Well, I don't think there are good things about. I think there, you know, the numbers came out from the Census Bureau saying that 45 million Americans do not have insurance. You have to look and analyze who are those 45 million Americans, because 16% of them are people who are earning over $75,000. 33% are people who are earning over $50,000. Just because you don't have health insurance does not mean you don't get health care. There is a lot of money spent by individuals who don't have health insurance, who go out and buy their own, they pay out of pocket for their health care. The really 8 million Americans are people who are chronically uninsured and low income. Those are the people that I think that the government needs to take care of, and I definitely believe that there are, you know, children and low-income families that do need care. But I think for the rest of people, we need to open up the system to empower consumers to get the best kind of health care that they can. I mean, people, when you look at any government program, most people do not like the DMV. The post office became more competitive when it opened up to competition from FedEx and UPS and a variety of things. Competition is what makes the world go round, and Canadians do not have any form of competition. Any private coverage in Canada is outlawed under the Canada Health Act.
Well, let me ask you, Sally Pipes, drugs, the cost of prescription drugs have become a huge part of health care costs in this country. And if our system, as it is now structured, is doing so well, why are so many Americans trying to get to Canada or to Mexico to buy drugs prescription drugs?
Today in America, Americans spend 1% of their income on prescription drugs. In the 1960s, Americans spent 1% of their income on prescription drugs. There are a number of drugs that are available in Canada, in the United States, that allow us to the drugs today allow us to live longer and healthier lives. From 1997 to 1999, out of 100 new drugs that became available in the United States, only 43 of them made it onto the formulary in Canada. A lot of the top drugs in the United States that are used in Canada are generically available in the United States and are cheaper. But the real issue here about prescription drugs, Americans want lower prices for prescription drugs. And the reason the drugs are lower in Europe and in Canada is because of price controls. So what people really want in America is price controls on drugs, which is going to have a negative impact on research and development in this country and innovation. And new drugs have reduced costs for hospital stays because people can use drugs now for ulcers, for gall, instead of having gallbladder surgery. So we're reducing hospital costs by allowing Americans to have access to the greatest drugs and innovation in the world.
Dr. Steffi, we'll handle, I'd like you to respond to the issue of drugs and the differences between Canada and the United States. And,
okay. Well, I want to remind you, Canadians do live 2 to 3 years longer than Americans, and that was not true before they went with national health insurance. And that's because the National Health Insurance Program has allowed them good access to all types of care, including drugs. Canadians, about half of Canadians do get their drugs through their insurance, but all Canadians benefit from a system whereby the government negotiates with drug companies for lower prices. So Canadians are paying about 60 cents on the dollar that Americans pay. We're paying only 60% of what we pay for drugs, and they really are the same drugs. Sally's idea that you can't get drugs in Canada is simply not true. They have access to the same drugs we do. They can just afford them. And similarly, Sally's contention that uninsured people get all the health care they need doesn't make common sense, but is also belied by a huge body of literature. Most recently, Ayanian and colleagues published a study looking at people aged 55 to 65 who have no health insurance, and 10% of those people died over an 8-year period. They died at a 33% higher rate than people who had insurance. It's just common sense that if you don't have a way to pay for care, you're going to get less of it, and it's going to impact your health and maybe make you die younger.
Who benefits under Bush's plan?
Well, there's a big benefit to some middle-income taxpayers who end up taking a tax credit where they already had insurance, and now they can get a tax credit that helps them pay, you know, pay for it. So there's some benefit to that. He's very big. In general, Bush's policies are very big with the insurance industry and drug industry because he has a very hands-off approach where all the government and taxpayers do is just send more money into the system. There's no attempt by the government to regulate things or make them more fair.
Sally Pipes?
Well, I'd like to just comment on one thing. Canada is a country of 32 million people, fewer than in the state of California. And we have much less ethnically diverse. We don't have the minority low-income populations that are in the United States. If you compare Canadians to white Americans, Americans are now living longer than Canadians. I think the Bush plan...
That isn't true. It's simply not true. The U.S.-Canada Health Survey...
We're going to actually have to leave it there, but I want to thank you both for being with us, and I know you both have to race off anyway. Sally Pipes, president of the San Francisco-based Pacific Research Institute. Her new book is called Miracle Cure, How to Solve America's Healthcare Crisis and Why Canada Isn't the Answer. Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to look at what happened in Iraq, the abduction of 2 Iraqi and 2 Italian humanitarian workers. Jeremy Scahill will join us. Stay with us. Rahima Hajj here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, 2 Americans and a British citizen were abducted in Baghdad today, according to the Iraqi Interior Ministry. A spokesman said that gunmen seized the men at dawn from a house in the capital's Mansour neighborhood, a wealthy residential area on the River Tigris where many multinational companies have their headquarters. The men were reportedly bundled into a minivan and driven away without a fight. The three men were reportedly employed by Gulf Services Company, a Middle East-based construction firm. This latest kidnapping brings the number of foreigners in Iraq currently being held to 20. What is virtually unreported by the international media is the kidnapping of Iraqis for ransom, which has become commonplace, particularly in Baghdad.
The kidnapping of the two U.S. citizens and the British citizen follows the abduction of two Italian and two Iraqi humanitarian workers last week. The women, Simona Toretta and Simona Pari, were abducted from their Baghdad office on September 7th, along with the Iraqi humanitarian workers Raad Ali Abdulaziz and Manuz Bassam. The four worked at A Bridge to Baghdad, the longest-standing non-governmental organization in Iraq. This is an excerpt of an interview in February with Simona Toretta, one of the Italian hostages. After we play this, we'll be speaking with Jeremy Scahill, who has a piece in The Guardian of London today. This clip, though, Simona Toretta, was recorded by filmmaker and activist Frances Anderson. Simona Toretta speaking last February.
So we reached Baghdad at 9, 10 o'clock. And when we reached Baghdad, there was the bombings. It was, first impact was very hard. I couldn't recognize Baghdad at all.
Were there bombings happening as you were driving in?
Yeah. And last time that I was in Baghdad was 1 month ago. And I found everything changed. I couldn't recognize Baghdad at the time. All the shops totally closed. The city empty, dark, smoke everywhere. And when I met my friends, they were just so surprised to see me, no? Say, why you came here? So dangerous for you. Go back in Italy. What are you doing here? Why you came? Are you crazy? Say, okay, no problem. I cannot stay in Italy. I decided to come here because there is a part of my life.
Simona Toretta recorded last February. She, along with her three colleagues, one Italian, two Iraqi, were abducted on September 7th in Baghdad. In today's British Guardian, Jeremy Scahill has a piece with Naomi Klein. Its headline, Who Seized Simona Toretta? This Iraqi kidnapping has the mark of an undercover police operation. Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Producer and correspondent, joins us in the studio. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy and Juan.
Well, Jeremy, tell us about this kidnapping and what, in terms of what you've discovered, makes it different from many of the other kidnappings we've seen in Iraq.
I think to answer that first, we have to look at who are the people that have been taken. Simona Toretta, Simona Pari, Raad Ali Abdulaziz, and Manaz Bassam were people who had dedicated their lives to not just bringing humanitarian relief to people in Iraq, but to taking a very strong stance against the sanctions when Saddam Hussein was president, against all bombings and attacks on Iraq, against the invasion of Iraq, and against the occupation of Iraq. These also were deeply political people. Simona Toretta and A Bridge to Baghdad, they were some of the key organizers of the large demonstrations on February 15th in Italy. Enormous demonstration. Political opponents of the regime of Silvio Berlusconi. And they were the longest-serving organization, NGO, in Iraq. They were there since 1992, very shortly after the so-called Gulf War ended. And the reason why that's significant is because after the so-called Gulf War, almost no international organizations would operate in Iraq because of the sanctions. And this was a group that defied that. And it was the group that inspired Voices in the Wilderness, the U.S.-based anti-sanctions campaign, to take up its work. And so what they were doing under the occupation was essentially defying the occupation regime. When the city of Fallujah was under siege in April. Bridge to Baghdad defied the U.S. sealing off of the city. They brought humanitarian supplies and stood in solidarity with civilians who were caught in the middle of the U.S. onslaught. And remember that what sparked the siege of Fallujah was the gruesome killing of the four Blackwater mercenaries. And Brigadier General Mark Kimmett threatened to crush the city and punish the entire city. And he said that the campaign would be methodical and it would be overwhelming. And they were there during that campaign. They were witnesses of it. When U.S. Marines laid siege to the holy city of Najaf in August, again, a bridge to Baghdad went where they were not supposed to go. They brought 250,000 gallons of water into the city, a water supply for the people who were caught in the middle of the fighting. And so on September 7th, when armed gunmen took them, a number of questions were raised by who would benefit from seizing these people. The way that it went down was at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Convoy of five cars pulls up on the street. Their office is right next to a hospital and only blocks away from the Green Zone, which houses the U.S. occupation authority in the form of the U.S. Embassy, as well as the Iraqi Governing Council. Gunmen get out of the cars, some of them not wearing masks at all, clean-shaven, business suits. They stop traffic on both sides of the street, very much like a law enforcement operation. And witnesses, in fact, we had some of the reports, eyewitness reports translated from Arabic into English, and many of the eyewitness reports say that people thought that it was a police operation because they were being stopped by men in uniforms. Several of the men were identified as having Iraqi National Guard uniforms on, which is significant, and I'll talk about that in a second. But they block off the street. Two men approach the Bridge to Baghdad office, and they have pistols with silencers and a stun gun. Now, I've never seen a stun gun in Iraq. I've never seen a pistol with a silencer, and I've never heard of those weapons being used by anyone within the Iraqi resistance. They say to the unarmed guards, really the doorman, at a Bridge to Baghdad, that they're from the office of Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. They proceed then to force their way into the building, and they don't just take the first people that they see. They're asking for Simona Toretta and Simona Perry by name. And when Manaz Bassam comes out to protest in the hallway, they grab her by her hijab, by her headscarf, and drag her from the building. This is an enormous religious transgression. For a woman to be grabbed by the headscarf that is on her head to cover her hair and to drag her in front of witnesses into a car and throw her there. I was talking to a friend of mine last night who's a Muslim, and I said, if this were to happen in a marketplace somewhere, what would happen? He said, they would be beaten probably to death for doing it. And so they drag her out. They also take Raad Ali Abdelaziz and the two Simonas. They put them in their cars, which included Land Cruisers, and they drive them off. 15 minutes later, a convoy of U.S. Humvees comes whizzing by from the direction that they had fled in. So it was coming from the opposite direction. This was an incredibly bold operation. It was very well coordinated, and it took place just blocks away from the Green Zone. So whoever pulled this off would have had to have had the confidence that they were going to be able to abduct these people in a very precise manner without a threat from the outside. And a number of questions are raised also by the fact that they identified themselves as representing the office of the unelected interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. Iyad Alawi himself is a spook, a lifelong spook. He was a Ba'ath Party assassin for Saddam Hussein, bumping off enemies of the regime in Europe. He was a Muhabarat, one of the feared secret police in Iraq. After his break with Saddam, he went on to work with MI6, the British intelligence, with Saudi intelligence, and has connections to the Central Intelligence Agency. One of the key components of the iron-fisted Iraqi interim government regime right now is that they have taken so many of the thugs that worked for Saddam Hussein and put them on the Iraqi government payroll. The United States has done the same. They've hired people who were repressing, torturing, abusing Iraqis under Saddam Hussein, and they play the exact same role in the current Iraq. Many of the witnesses to this abduction said that it reminded them of the days of Saddam Hussein's Muhabarat. And I heard when I was in Iraq, particularly in 2002, so many stories about people being snatched from their homes, taken away, disappeared, never to be heard from again. And this has a lot of similarities to that.
Well, but clearly, I mean, the uniforms could have been stolen, and while I agree with you, with the weaponry seemed more advanced than your normal resistance fighters, is there any other indication that, for instance, has any group claimed responsibility for it? What's been the reaction of other resistance groups or within Iraq?
Two groups have claimed responsibility, one on the shortly after the abductions happened, and then another one identified as Ansar al-Zawahiri, supposedly named after the number two man in al-Qaeda. But these groups were basically unknown in Iraq, and the statements were not posted in any kind of, in that world, in any kind of a credible way. They were posted on internet chat rooms on Arabic websites. It wasn't like they posted them as this big declaration with video and photos. They were posted in a chat room that anyone could have had access to. There's been no photographs. There's been no video whatsoever. As what I think is also significant is that according to one of the leaders of the most important Sunni cleric organization in Iraq, Sheikh al-Qabesi, the women came and met with him the day that before they were kidnapped.
The two Simonas.
The two Simonas and Raad Ali Abdulaziz. They came and met with him at the Mother of All Villages Mosque in Baghdad. It's a gigantic Sunni mosque. And they were explaining to him that they were planning to begin another aid operation into Fallujah. There are some reports that indicate that they told them that they wanted to refocus their work on the city of Fallujah. They had been there before, and he is one of the main people who can facilitate getting in and out of Fallujah. He also is someone who has successfully negotiated hostage releases in the past. So they went and they met with him, and they told him that they were being threatened and that people were pressuring them to change the nature of their work. And he refused to say who it was that was threatening them. He said for their safety. But he said that that no Iraqi group did this, that no Iraqi resistance group did this, and suggested that it was done by foreign intelligence services. Now, CIA and Mossad conspiracies run rampant all over Baghdad, as they do in any kind of a conflict area. But coming from him, it carries a bit more weight because of his involvement and connections to resistance groups. The other key factor here is that these kidnappings have sparked more of an outcry and an outrage from Islamic groups, not just in Iraq, but around the world, who support violent resistance in Iraq itself. Hezbollah has called for their release. Islamic Jihad has called for their release. The Algerian Islamic leader, Abbas Madani, has announced a hunger strike to the death for their freedom from Qatar, where he is in exile. Resistance group in Fallujah released a statement saying that they should be released. Whoever did this is against the noble and honest resistance of Iraq and is working for foreign forces bent on keeping Iraqi soil away from Iraqi power. So you have this enormous response from many groups who support jihad or uprising in Iraq.
Interesting. You point out a Newsweek piece that opens with a description of the abduction. An English word is used.
Yeah. Another thing about this pristine operation, which according to...
And we only have 1 minute.
According to an Iraqi journalist who witnessed the scene, happened to be in the area, the whole thing took less than 5 minutes, the abduction. Some say 10 minutes. What's interesting is Newsweek and others reported, they quoted eyewitnesses as saying that there was one man who was in charge, a clean-shaven man in a gray suit, who the others referred to as sir. And I think that we don't know who took these women. But the point is that there are people who know who have these women. And we cannot rule out the possibility that it was not an Iraqi resistance group. This hurts the Iraqi resistance tremendously. And you always have to ask who benefits in cases like this.
And this last point that they were going to even rename their group or a subgrouping.
Yeah, that's what Sheikh al-Qabesi said. He said that they were considering renaming their organization Fallujah Emergency, but that is something that people close to them doubt, and they believe that they simply wanted to start a program of bringing aid into Fallujah.
And really focusing on
Fallujah. And focus on Fallujah, where the United States is again launching a
major offensive. Website for people to get more information, of course, democracynow.org will link.
You can go to freeourfriends.blogspot.com. That's a site that's compiling a lot of the information. And then on our website, we're going to post this article and others.
And the article that Jeremy Scahill wrote with Naomi Klein is in today's British Guardian. It's called Who Sees Simona Toretta. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent. That does it for today's program. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.